Welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher. Wetlands play a vital role in preserving the environment by filtering and controlling the water flow between ecosystems. Joining us today is an eminent expert on the topic. He's founder and former director of the Olentangy River Wetland Research Park at Ohio State University and now director of Everglades Wetland Research Park at Florida Gulf Coast University. Bill Mitch, welcome back to the show.
And it's great to be back.
You know, wetlands are not just a local concern. How we manage them up here affects what you do down there, right?
Well, I think it was a great experience to start the wetland research site here because we learned a heck of a lot about wetlands that we can apply anywhere, and especially the Florida Everglades.
Wetlands aren't the same everywhere, though, right? They look differently.
Yeah, there's many different types. There's freshwater, saltwater, and then even between those, there's different types of freshwater systems. So, yeah, you can come up with a list of 20 different types, and probably that's a manageable number. And, they're all different.
When I was growing up, they were everywhere. Mm-hmm. We used to go, you know, poke around in them, and they were just kind of part of the scenery. They're not everywhere anymore.
Well, that's the basic issue that we're facing on a world scale. It's not just the United States. And in fact, the U.S., we've kind of slowed down the loss rate. It was enormous for 200 years.
About half.
Yeah, we lost half our wetlands. So we've slowed that down considerably for two reasons. There aren't very many wetlands left. And also because we have a very, very strong program of wetland protection in the United States. It's probably one of the strongest protections for any ecosystem. Lakes don't have that kind of protection. Rivers are kind of getting it, and even forests. So wetlands have a special place in the environmental legal world, if you call it that.
Why can't we just replace them with something, I guess, for lack of a better word, synthetic? Why can't we do the same thing without having the wetlands there? Can't we make a wetland?
Well, that was what I have specialized, especially in Ohio, because we drained the whole state. So I couldn't very well say I was in Ohio to study wetlands. So we said, we'll study wetlands, creating and restoring wetlands. So, yes, in principle, I believe you can do that. But I also believe there are a lot of people that don't understand wetlands. They don't understand how to create and restore them, and they've bungled it so many times that a lot of people are, including some of my peers in the country, are saying you can't create and restore a wetland because they don't work. Well, that's the fault of the people that started them, not the fact that you can't do it. We believe you can create and restore wetlands, yes.
You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. We're talking about American wetlands. It is American Wetlands Month.
Yes.
In May, there's a American Wetlands Month national webinar on the Ramsar Treaty / Convention on Wetlands on Wednesday, May 27th from 2 to 4 p.m. If you want to know more about that, you can go to the link on our website at WOSU.org/allsides. With me today is William Mitch. He's the director of the Everglades Wetland Research Park and founder of the Wilma Schirmeyer Olentangy River Wetland Research Park at Ohio State University, where he was for, about 20 years?
26 years at Ohio State,
years,
but
yeah.
20 easy at the wetlands, yeah.
Yeah. 614-292-8513 is the number to call. If you have a question for my guest, Bill Mitch, you can also email us at allsides@wosu.org or check out the Facebook page and post your question or comment there. On Wednesday, policymakers from across the Midwest met in Columbus to talk about how to ease the dead zone.
Yeah.
In the Gulf of Mexico that's caused by agricultural runoff. And it's the same kind of problem that's creating the toxic algae in Lake Erie every summer, which is kind of going to my point about the wetlands here and how we manage our agriculture here affects things very far away.
Yeah, I'm sorry I missed that hypoxia meeting. I just heard about it a couple of days ago and I already had an appointment. But that was our consummate project that we worked on here at Ohio State for, I'd say 15 years, was seeing how wetlands could be a solution to that hypoxia in the Gulf of Mexico. And we came up, the federal government asked me in the about 1997, 98, 99, somewhere in there, to chair a panel, a national panel, to solve the problem of the hypoxia. And here they are still meeting 15 years. So we told them the answer, and we told them it was very simple. You've got to have a good management of fertilizers and a sound plan to not over-fertilize and so on. But that's not enough. That would not be enough to just do agronomic things. We said you had to build about, and the number we gave was 5 million acres of wetlands in the Midwest.
Which is used to filter.
To filter the water, especially to take nitrogen out. And that even if it's not nitrogen, but most people agree it is in the Gulf of Mexico, even if it's phosphorus, by the way, the wetlands will take phosphorus out as well. So, yeah, we called for a massive restoration of the Midwest to make it soggy again.
And they're still talking about it 15 years
They're still talking about it and, you know.
When you talk about the hypoxia in the Gulf of Mexico, they say it's an area, I think, roughly the size of Connecticut. I might be wrong about that. It's very, very large.
Yeah,
what does it look like? What is it?
Well, first of all, we used to say it was the size of the state of New Jersey, and still we had a U.S. EPA administrator who was from New Jersey. And then at that time, I think we said it was the size of Massachusetts.
Okay.
So now they're picking Connecticut, sure.
Well, I'm just picking. I'm sure I mixed up the East Coast.
No, it probably is Connecticut. It's a very large area where the oxygen is depleted in the bottom waters, supposedly by the same process that's going on in Lake Erie, the same process we're worrying about in the Florida Everglades, excess nutrients coming from mainly agricultural runoff.
Taking up that oxygen.
It creates oxygen. It creates
excess.
Algae. The algae falls to the bottom and depletes the oxygen. That's what's going on in the Gulf of Mexico.
And it's called a dead zone.
Yes.
Why is that?
Because the bottom waters in that shallow area of the Gulf of Mexico are dead from biological activity. The oxygen is depleted because of all the gunk.
So there's no more fish,
algae.
No more
Well, the fish have
life?
To move, but yes, exactly. That's a term the press put on it. Hypoxia is the formal term, but...
And if those 5 million acres of wetland appeared overnight, how long would it take to... Can we cure that problem, or is it just a matter of keeping it from spreading farther?
I think the 5-million-acre wetland goal, it still should be a goal, by the way, it would take years for it to manifest itself in the watershed. It's not an instant. That's one of the things we're always looking for is instant solutions to problems. And in nature, that's not the way it works. And this is the same concept when we talk about building a wetland. You don't build them overnight. You don't push a button and all you got a wetland. They take time. That's one of the big messages I've been pushing.
And the other thing is wetlands and rivers and lakes, they don't know what state they're in.
Right.
They don't care what state they're in. But when we talk about policymakers from across the Midwest, we have policymakers coming here from different states with different policies and different politics and that kinds of thing.
Yeah.
The Gulf of Mexico doesn't care.
Right. In fact, it may be the hypoxia. I'm not going to say it's a good thing. It's not because it really does deplete the biology and the coastline. But It's not a disaster in one sense, but in the other it is, because it really shows that we are not controlling our pollution coming off our mid part of the continent here. It goes 1,000 kilometers to the south before it gets into the Gulf of Mexico.
President Obama used a commencement address on Wednesday at the Coast Guard Academy to push for action to combat climate control or climate change as a national security imperative. He said that the warming of the planet poses an immediate risk to the United States. What do you think of that in terms of wetlands protection, particularly down in Florida?
Well, last month, President Obama actually came to the Everglades, and he sort of has described the Everglades as the new poster child of climate change because of sea level rise. And because we're so close to the sea down there, we're only a few inches to feet above the sea level down there, any change in sea level is going to drastically affect the Everglades. So we've already gotten involved in that issue. We're doing a lot of research down there that applies to that. But one of the things that is going to happen down there, there's a highway that goes across the Everglades called Tamiami Trail. Many people go down to Florida know about that. Mm-hmm. It goes from Naples to Miami.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a highway, but it's fill. It's not a bridge. And so I had the opportunity. In fact, I was on Here and Now on NPR in April. And I said, I think it should be a 75-mile bridge. Well, nobody has ever even remotely thought
of that scale.
In other
words, let's bring back the Everglade.
The water has to
go under it,
not just stop at it, especially with sea level rise. It's called coastal squeeze is what's going to go on. The wetlands that are south on the ocean side of Tamiami Trail are going to get squeezed out of existence. because the water will be too deep.
And so if the water, if it was, wouldn't it, if doesn't it keep the rising water levels from getting the rest of the Everglades, though? Blocking them?
Oh, no, that's not a good thing. We want the water to flow freely north and south. Whatever the sea gives us is what the sea gives us. We're stuck with that. We don't. Let's not.
That's always been the way it is.
Yeah, let's not build more barriers to the sea. But what it also stops is the fresh water coming down.
Okay.
And that's, of course, a gigantic issue in the Everglades right now. Everybody's saying, send the water south, send the water south, because right now it goes east and west. It's a long story of what's going on in the Everglades, but it's an absolute mess as far as the current status of the restoration.
And who's in charge of the – it's national, right?
The restoration?
Mm-hmm.
Well, we're paying for half of it. Half of it is being paid by the U.S. taxpayer and the other half is paid by the Florida taxpayers. But it's a $20 billion project.
And it doesn't involve building a bridge?
Well, interestingly, they did bridge 2 miles of it, and they made such a big deal of it. Oh, my gosh. Governor was there cutting ribbons and all this stuff for 2 miles. Excuse me, you need to bridge 75 miles. But it's a start, and it cost a fortune, by the way they did it. So, yeah, I guess that would be a perfect example of an adaptation that we're going to need to do to protect the environment, to bridge the Tamiami Trail.
The 2 miles cost a fortune. The 2 miles of bridge of the Tamiami Trail over the Everglades cost a fortune. What's it going to cost us if we don't arrest this depletion of the wetlands?
Well, we're just going to lose the ecosystems. They're going to be flooded out on the south side, on the north side. We're trying to get the water to go from Lake Okeechobee. I'm sorry if I'm explaining things that our listeners don't know about, but basically we want to go the water south all the way from Disney World, if that's a good frame of reference, all the way down the Kissimmee, through Lake Okeechobee, down the Everglades, and down to the sea, including under our Tamiami Trail. That's where it's supposed to go. And they're trying to get more and more fresh water to go to revive the Florida Everglades, which is basically depleted from that fresh water. So it's a very complicated thing, but we just need to let the flows go where they're supposed to go.
You said earlier we drained Ohio. That would be the Great Black Swamp up in...
That was a very big chunk of it, yes.
Yeah. But we've drained everything, you said?
On the inventory they did a few years ago, Ohio was number two in the nation for the highest percentage loss. I think we were 90% loss of wetlands. We were beat out by 1%. California is 91%. That's not a very nice distinction to have, to be honest. So that's when I moved to Ohio, I mean, people said, Professor Rich, why are you moving to Ohio?
Right.
And I said, well, I guess we're going to restore wetlands. So that's what actually we emphasized here when we were at Ohio State.
And has Ohio achieved that? I know that you've got the Wetlands Research Park here, but...
I think we had a little role in there's a gigantic interest in wetlands down in Ohio. I'm very pleased. In fact, I come back in the summers, every summer. I still have a home in Upper Arlington, and I'm on the Ohio Wetland Association. I'm on their board. So I'm very active still in Ohio wetlands, and I'm very, very excited to see that this state is really picking up for losses.
It didn't have anywhere to go but up, though.
Right, right.
My guest is William Mitch. He's director of the Everglades Wetland Research Park and founder and longtime director of the Olentangy River Wetland Research Park at Ohio State University. His book has just come out in a fifth edition, Wetlands. It is considered, I guess, the wetlands Bible to many people in the business. And if you have a chance, check it out. We'll have a link to that on our website at WOSU.org/allsides. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides. I'm Ann Fisher. We're talking about wetlands. which in the lower 48 now make up a total acreage roughly equal to the state of California. About 500 years ago, there was twice as much wetlands in the continental United States. Among other things, wetlands buffer us from flood damages, drought damages, and provide refuge for all manner of fowl. Still with us is an eminent expert on the topic, Bill Mitch. He designed, built, and managed from 1992 to 2012 the Olentangy River Wetland Research Center at Ohio State University. And now he's director of the Everglades Wetland Research Park at Florida Gulf Coast University. He is the author of Wetlands, which came out in a fifth edition in March. It's been described as the Wetland Bible. Scientists are saying now that Lake Erie will see a smaller toxic algae bloom this summer because the Maumee River is carrying less phosphorus to the western part of the lake. But they couch it in all kinds of things. Yeah, unless there's a lot of rain in May and June, and unless, you know, there's many, many factors. I feel like we're sort of watching the toxic algae estimates like we watch, you know, how much particulate matter is in the air on summer days when they tell you to stay indoors. We're measuring, doing a lot of measuring, but it doesn't seem like it really isn't something that we have as much control over as we'd like to think.
No, I mean, I'm a scientist, and scientists are good at describing problems. Sometimes scientists are not very good at solving problems. In fact, that's why we started the field here when I was at Ohio State, called ecological engineering. It's meant to solve ecological problems, not just talk about them, not just to describe them in great detail. Yeah, the prediction thing, I don't know. I think they're taking after the folks down in Louisiana who have been predicting for a number of years the size of the hypoxia based on rainfall in the Midwest and all sorts of other variables. So I guess they're just following the same idea.
But the issue with the toxic algae in Lake Erie, also Grand Lake St. Mary's, you know, Buckeye Lake's going to have problems with it this year for obvious reasons because of the depletion. You know, there's not enough water there, and they've struggled with it anyway. This is all over the place now, and it's been going on for, it has to be a long time.
I think we're just now starting to see that nature's had enough, if you can describe
it's worn out.
Worn out with us putting nutrients in. Maybe it had a little buffer zone in the beginning. And we're just seeing a manifestation of green lakes and green coastlines. That's what it is all over the world. Somebody counted 760 episodic hypoxia or green lake phenomena like Lake Erie or like the Gulf of Mexico in the world. That's enormous problem. And we don't seem to be slowing down. We're just still adding nitrogen and phosphorus. Those are the main culprits. It's the same chemical when you buy a bag of fertilizer. It's NPK. It's the N and the P that are causing all the trouble, usually with the P, the phosphorus, being freshwater problem, and usually with the nitrogen being coastal problem. Not always, but that's a nice rule of thumb.
Why is that?
It just has to do with the limit. It's called the limiting factor concept. The nitrogen is more limiting in a coastal system, whereas there's enough phosphorus there already. The opposite is true in freshwater systems. They just seem to be limited by phosphorus.
And once nature sort of gives up and tires out and gets worn out, it happens very quickly.
Yeah.
It spreads
fast. That's not exactly how it works.
But I get what you're saying.
Yeah, that's a nice way of describing
it. Once there's a tipping point,
I guess is the way to put it. And there's no turning back. It's not exactly reversible thing. You can't just turn off the spigot and it'll – because often what – a lot of the nutrients are not coming from the watershed. They're coming from the bottom muck that's built up over 100 years in a lake, for example. And that's a source of nutrients for heaven knows how many years, even if you are cutting off the source. But but ultimately, the absolute solution to these is cutting off the source. The other things, you have people that will spray copper sulfate and make the pond look clean. That's what they do a lot of in Florida now.
Is that why sometimes it looks like strangely blue?
Yes.
I wondered about that.
There's a little greenish tint to it sometimes. Yeah. That could be copper sulfate. It could be something
else. And they can just spray it on the water.
Oh, yeah. So that now in Florida, for example, the copper pollution in the sediments is a serious problem. That's a toxic chemical.
Is it legal?
It's still legal if you have a permit to do so and you're trained to apply the right amount. It's still legal even in Florida, and I think they should just ban copper sulfate. It's just that's another chemical. It cleaned the lakes in the 50s. We're paying for it now. You know, we're paying for it 40 and 50 years later.
Because it's just for looks.
Yes. And this is not a symptom thing. That's what we like our lakes to be clean. We like them to be pretty. We like them to be open. And when you get anything growing on them or in them, algae, even any kind of plants coming through, everybody gets alarmed and they have sessions and they have meetings and they try to solve problems. And the problem is with the nutrients coming in from outside of that lake or body of water.
You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. We're talking about wetlands today with a preeminent expert, Bill Mitch. He's director of the Everglades Wetland Research Park. He also is founder of the Olentangy River Wetland Research Park at Ohio State University. It's right along the bike trail there. You can visit it all the time. I mean, almost any time. If you have a question or comment, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. You can also check us out on Facebook and post a question or a comment there, or send us a note by Twitter at @WOSUAllSides. In March, you won an international award for your wetland research and teaching. It was from the Ramsar Convention. Mm-hmm. And congratulations for
that.
You were the only North American to win one of the six awards issued every year. What is Ramsar? What is the significance of this?
Well, first of all, I think they only issue them once every 3 years.
Okay.
As I know, they only have this big meeting they're having in Uruguay once every 3 years. But thank you. That was a nice distinction. It's going to be awarded to me in June. June 3rd. I'm going down there to see what they have to say, but it's a nice thing. Ramsar is a international treaty, if you can call it that, they call it convention, that 168 countries, perhaps, or maybe you have a better number, but it's something like 168 parties or countries belong to. It's not the United Nations. It's its own thing. It was started a long time ago in the early 70s as a way of protecting waterfowl that didn't know whether they were in Iran or Iraq or whatever, you know.
Again, they don't know where the boundaries are, right?
They don't know political boundaries. And so it started out as waterfowl protection, but very quickly morphed into a wetland protection because that's where the waterfowl go. So it's an amazing program. I just love it. And they make all their decisions, as I understand, at these big meetings that happen once every 3 years, by consensus. Can you imagine 168 countries getting together and agreeing by consensus on resolutions? That's exactly what goes on there. Yeah, I can't either.
There's some bodies of decision makers that could probably take a page from that book.
Absolutely. So it's a great thing politically, let alone ecologically. And their number one mission is to protect and save the wetlands of the world, which are very, very much in jeopardy now. That's the big story now, not so much the U.S. wetlands.
It's worldwide.
Worldwide. We are just losing enormous.
Where are some real hot spots for that now?
Well, Brazil has always been a problem, and now they're putting dams on all the rivers that go into the Amazon.
The Amazon, right.
A little worse. Indonesia, China. I was on Chinese TV 2 nights ago on CCTV, and they're very concerned, and they had numbers that they said something like they've lost half of their natural wetlands in the last 50 years or something like that. They have big loss numbers. New Zealand lost a lot of wetlands a long time ago, but they had a very accurate number. They just said we lost 90% of our wetlands in New Zealand. So it's everywhere. But I think in the developing countries, especially now, the ones that are getting prosperous and rich, those are the ones that are basically destroying their wetlands for commerce and agriculture or whatever. And those are the ones, I think, where the loss rates are enormous.
And what does it mean to the rest of the world? I mean, if we lose 90% of all of our wetlands in the world, can we survive?
Well, we can survive as long as we have energy, and of course that's an interesting question, isn't it, whether we have that, the energy to create artificial solutions to all the problems that will cause, because wetlands clean the water. Now you're going to have to build a water treatment plant. Wetlands sequester carbon out of the atmosphere, so now you have to have some contraption that pulls carbon out of the atmosphere. Wetlands create biota, so we'll just have more zoos and artificial ways of seeing animals and plants. So we artificially can solve all these problems, but the energy costs are enormous. Plus, you're losing a natural ecosystem that we shouldn't lose.
You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. You know, a lot of people don't realize still the impact of wetlands loss off the coast of Louisiana and what the result of that was when it came to Katrina.
Yes.
And Ike, for that matter, the hurricanes.
Right. And that is one of the astounding stories. Again, I keep telling NPR, but I believe it was 2003, John Day, who from LSU, and I were on NPR out of Cleveland. I remember that because we were both here in Columbus. And we predicted Katrina by everything except her name. We said it's going to happen. It's going to be a disaster. I wish I could find that tape.
Because those wetlands hold off the
surges. Because the wetlands
surges.
Were being destroyed at an enormous rate, not by any development. They're just basically sinking into the sea. Because all the good sediments that we send down from Ohio and Illinois and Indiana and especially even the Missouri River, the Big Muddy, that sediment load has dropped, believe it or not. But also they decided they didn't want the river to flood the delta anyhow. They've straightened it and will go straight out into the abyss of the Gulf of Mexico. Why? So big ships can come up to New Orleans and New Orleans can have a big commerce. Well, New Orleans had big commerce for 100 years and they paid dearly for it. Because they should not be I won't say they shouldn't be a port, but they should not have isolated the river from the delta. That was a basic problem.
Ron in Buckeye Lake, you're on the air. Hi, Ron. I guess I know what you want to talk about.
Well, thank you for taking the call. I'm a big fan of your show.
You bet.
As more and more of the Buckeye Lake, the sediment is exposed as it's drying up and in the drier months. Is there an opportunity, since the problem at Buckeye Lake is supposed to take 5 years to resolve, to clean up the sediments? And then how do you do that? I mean, is it just you can't move it to some other place and just move a problem from one place to another?
Yeah,
is
I think
there,
that, yeah.
Go ahead.
Well, I think it's interesting. I mean, is this an opportunity by, you know, lowering the water levels to fix the dam? Is this an opportunity to improve something? I think it's a good question, Ron. Thank you.
Well, one of the things that the people do use for restoring lakes is to dredge the sediments out of the lake. Yes, of course. I mean, think of it this way. A lake is a temporary landscape feature in the geological scale. And as soon as they're a lake and you get a little algal production, the system builds and builds and starts to fill in. In fact, there was the old, it's not exactly true, but the old idea that lakes would fill in and then eventually become wetlands and then uplands. But they, at least they're, the lake doesn't know any better. It wants to, it's perfectly fine to fill in. I'm sorry we have to put it in a human term like that. But so yes, if you want to manage a deep lake, occasionally you're just going to have to dredge materials out of it. So sure, this might be an opportunity. But on the other hand, what is interesting is Cranberry Bog is sitting out there, and that's the floating bog. Why is it a floating bog? Because they made the lake. It used to be firmly attached to the strata, and now it's floating. If they drop the water level low enough, and I'm just speculating, maybe Cranberry Bog will – some of the roots will grab the substrate below, and it won't float to the surface when they do raise the water level. I mean, that's just sheer speculation on my part, but that is such an important bioreserve, I think we have to protect it.
Why is it important?
Well,
it's 12,000 years old, they
yes,
say.
Yes, it's 12,000-year-old bog that we don't have any anymore, very few. And, of course, because it's artificial, because it's floating, I think it's the only floating bog in the world.
Yeah.
Probably not the only one, but it's the only artificially floating bog in the world. So I guess we have that unique feature. But, yes, you can restore temporarily. It's like it's the same thing as using the copper sulfate. You can restore a lake temporarily by dredging the sediments out of the bottom because they are often the source of at least half the nutrients for the lake.
But if you keep pouring the same stuff into it over time, you're going to have the same problems.
Right. So maybe you just have a policy of dredging it. I mean, I understand people want open bodies of water for lakes, for boating and fishing and all that. I understand that completely. I'm just saying to manage a lake here, and especially when you have fertilizers going into it, it's going to take a lot of cost. Dredging is an enormously expensive operation.
All right, Ron, thanks for that call and thanks for listening. If all that stuff's going into the waterways, all the fertilizers and stuff, would you eat a fish from one of these rivers?
Well, in this sense, yes, because nitrogen and phosphorus is not a toxic chemical. It's, you know, they're very important building blocks of life.
Okay.
And so we have nitrogen and phosphorus in us. It's about a ratio of 10 to 1, roughly, 10 times more nitrogen and phosphorus. So, yeah, what you worry about are the other stuff. Like if they're copper sulfate, I would worry about.
Okay.
Because you'd be ingesting copper. If they're using pesticides on the farm as well as nitrogen and phosphorus, I would worry about it. So if they're spraying for mosquitoes around the edge to, you know. So if they're adding toxic chemicals by whatever means, I would worry. But nitrogen and phosphorus by themselves are not. Well, they can be toxic if they create toxic algae, but they themselves are just fertilizer. We fertilize our fields all the time. So we're basically mass consumers of nitrogen and phosphorus.
Our farms are, and we need our farms to grow the food
right,
that we've become accustomed to having on our grocery store shelves and in the coolers and so forth. I was kind of curious about you talked about the 168 countries coming together like they have for many, many years now. Are there any successes that they can point to when they do have – you said that they actually come to consensus when they meet. Are there any – is there any evidence that it matters?
I think in the rest of the world – and I'm leaving U.S. out for temporarily for this discussion. In the rest of the world, there is a distinction of a – If a site becomes a Ramsar wetland, it's like a badge of approval. It's like an underwriter laboratory stamp of approval, if you will. And the rest of the world understands that. We don't understand that at all in the U.S. We got the Olentangy site to be a Ramsar wetland. It's one of only 37 in the United States, and it's the only one still in Ohio. I would have thought we'd have 10 more in Ohio by now. So it's that's the value of the Ramsar Convention to a great degree in the rest of the world is it's a international body that recognizes that, hey, that's an important wetland internationally, not just nationally. And most people point to it with great amount of pride. But that's the trouble. I'm the chair of the U.S. Ramsar Committee now, and you go to say, would you like to be a Ramsar wetland? And people say, well, no. What do we get out of that? What's
in it for us?
What's in it for us?
We're talking about wetlands. My guest is William Mitch. He's director of the Everglades Wetland Research Park and founder of the Olentangy River Wetland Research Park at Ohio State University. If you have a question or comment, this is the guy to ask. So give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. We're talking about the depletion and preservation of what's left of our wetlands and their impact on our environment. My guest is Bill Mitch. He's founder and former director of the Olentangy River Wetland Research Park at Ohio State University. He's now director of the Everglades Wetland Research Park at Florida Gulf Coast University. And he's the author of Wetlands, which came out in a fifth edition in March. If you have a question or comment for him, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. In your eyes, is it, you know, the major threats to wetlands today when we, if you subtract the United States from the equation, because we know what the problem is, we dug most of them up, we buried them, filled them in to build housing tracts or a lot for farming. Mm-hmm. Around the world, when you talk about in the developing countries, what are they grappling with when it comes to that? What they're not necessarily building a lot, are they? Or
well, yeah. I mean, we're getting a lot of our food. Like a good example is shrimp. I have colleagues who are in the mangrove wetland business who said we should ban people eating shrimp. Now, can you imagine?
No.
How all the parties of the
New Year's Eve parties around the world.
Yes, would collapse. because it's a very simple trade-off that's going on there. A mangrove swamp is a coastal wetland. It's a forested coastal wetland found in the tropics and the subtropics. We have one of the most wonderful mangrove swamps in the world down in Florida. Florida has one of the best mangrove swamps left because we protect it like crazy. You're not allowed to do anything in those mangrove swamps now. They've drained a lot of them, of course, for Marco Island and places like that, but no more. So it's they're protected systems. Well, mangrove swamps are being converted to shrimp ponds at an enormous rate.
Around the world.
Mm-hmm. And here's the additional problem. The shrimp farms ponds are only good for about 5 years, and then they turn sour. It's a chemical thing. They build up too much sulfur. And then they abandon them and go destroy more mangroves. So they're just like moving around the mangrove wetlands, destroying them to produce the shrimp. And if you go to the store and buy one of those big frozen – look at one of those bags in the frozen container section.
Mm-hmm.
Look on the back of where it comes from, what country it comes from. And I almost guarantee you it will be somewhere in Southeast Asia or somewhere there that is producing shrimp cheaply for us, and we're destroying mangroves by
and if they're calling it farmed shrimp, that's part of that.
Well, yeah, that's definitely farmed. Although, you know, they might be calling it coastal shrimp because they're growing them on the coastline.
Gotcha.
It's just that they're destroying mangrove swamps,
right. Digging
big ponds, getting 5 years worth of shrimp out of it, and then moving on and destroying more mangroves. It is one of the worst cases of substitution of aquaculture for an ecosystem that is on the face of the earth.
And it's like locusts.
Yeah, it's terrible because those mangroves just do not come back, and they try to restore them, and they've just made such a mess. And the mangroves are what were needed when the tsunami of 2004. A lot of people forget about that. That was a year before Hurricane Katrina. The tsunami around the Indian Ocean that was caused by an earthquake, enormous death. It was one of the biggest human disasters ever in the world, like 260,000 people killed. And it turns out that the people who had protected their mangroves and left them there and not changed them into fish ponds or whatever, they were a little bit more protected. The mangroves stood there and took the brunt of the tsunami wave, which is like a hurricane wave, took the brunt of that and protected the people who were smart enough to live behind the mangroves. But the people who were living out where the mangroves used to be, they were or built a development. There were also developments that were built. They were obliterated by that tsunami.
Sandy in Columbus, you're on the air. Hi, Sandy.
Hi. Thank you for being on today. As I understand it, there are injection wells just north of Columbus in the wetlands themselves, also around the wetlands, but actually in the wetlands.
You mean injection wells where they inject in refuse from mining operations?
Right, from fracking.
With the toxic
chemicals that we don't know what they are.
And they're shooting them into wetlands.
Well, they're probably trying to shoot it below the wetland, but what you're saying is they have to go through the wetland to get there.
Yes. Well, actually, that was my question. I was wondering if you had any. I understand with the fracking industry that these injection well encasements will be last forever and ever. I don't know anything that lasts forever and ever. So I was wondering if you had any concerns about that.
I would, because why do they have to use the wetland as a place for injection? Why can't they move, outside of the wetland? It seems a little silly to me that they even do that. But, that's that whole fracking thing. I think that's a case I'm sure you've covered it in your program many times, Ann, but that's a whole other case of uncertainties more than anything right now. We just don't know what it's going to create for us.
A lot of short-term gain, but
yeah,
it's a long-term question.
But I do have to tell a little personal story about our old Tangi wetlands. It was about 5 years ago, 7 years ago when I was director, where there was a proposal to put a pipeline under the wetland
right. By
I won't name the company, and I won't name the perpetrators of that idea. It was the dumbest thing I ever heard of in my life, and we were able to stop it. Basically, the whole world wrote letters, and that's very true. I have copies of 25 letters that came from all the world that said, Ohio State, don't you dare do that. And then there was a Facebook page that had 500 students involved saying, don't you dare do that. And so Ohio State very wisely chose not to put the pipeline under the wetland. But the fact that they were considering it was just absurd. So anyhow, that's a side story. But
Sandy, where are those injection wells located? Could you be more specific? Sandy?
I know they're north, I think, Morrill County.
Okay. Okay.
I'm really concerned what happens if one of those should leak, and I know that others have leaked around the country. What would happen if they did leak? What would happen to our water source?
I'd be concerned, especially because we don't have very many wetlands left in Ohio. Why mess up the ones that are left?
Okay, Sandy, thanks for that call. Bob in Worthington, you're on the air. Hi, Bob.
Hi. Bill knows me. I worked with him for years. I'm a policy guy.
Okay.
Hi, Bob.
I just wanted to add a little bit to what you said about where we get our information about what we predict is going to happen in Lake Erie and elsewhere in Ohio about the level of cryptosporidium and algae, and also about the time that the phosphorus and other nutrients will stay in Lake Erie. First of all, the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration has a Great Lakes office, and they look at all the weather data and everything, and they make predictions. As a matter of fact, in the Columbus Dispatch a couple of days ago, they predicted what's going to happen.
Right.
It depends on the levels of spring and early summer rainfall patterns. Secondly, Lake Erie is the shallowest of our Great Lakes, and if we were to stop the phosphorus going into it, it would, and other like nitrogen, it would flow through very rapidly. That doesn't apply to other lakes like Grand Lake, St. Mary's, and others. And I have a question, Bill. Have you been keeping up with the headwater stream controversy? Water quality standards don't apply to our headwater streams. Water quality standards have criteria, physical, and use designations, but scientists have shown that what happens up in the headwaters, which are actually the governors make decisions on whether they're protected or not, and it gets very political.
But
we're trying to extend the standards up to them, and it's very controversial. And I just want you to comment on those things.
Okay.
Well, tell us, thank you, Bob, for the call. What's a headwater stream?
Well, that's a small order stream. That's the first streams in the watershed, where the rivers start, basically. They're called first order, second order streams. And Bob's right. Those tend to be – the Army Corps of Engineers likes big rivers. So the federal government, as a rule, is now regulating big rivers and obvious rivers. And they've left the stuff on the floodplain and the stuff in the upper waters to the states to manage. I'm very much simplifying what's going on and as far as the way we govern it, but that's what it is.
Yep.
So it's usually state governments that are responsible for the small intermittent streams, and not entirely, but the stuff upstream and the floodplains. Who knows who's controlling it? Bob, I don't know the details of that rule, but it applies to an area, a new brand new area. They're called conductivity. It's finally dawned on people that wetlands are connected to rivers. But it's become a big point of debate in the federal government, and they're trying to resolve all these problems. So yeah, these are just small issues, but a big picture of trying to regulate wetlands and shallow bodies of water in our states.
We have a few minutes left with Bill Mitch of the Everglades Wetland Research Park, and also founder and for many years director of the Olentangy River Wetland Research Park right out here at the OSU campus. If you have a question or comment, you can get the call in, 614-292-8513. We have an email from Tom in Upper Arlington. He asks if you're familiar with the permaculture scientists like David Bloom with their wetlands movement. Apparently, there are more than 500 community-sponsored wetlands throughout the U.S. where they use cattail marshes to treat water and then harvest the cattails for ethanol fuel. And he's interested in your comments on that.
Well, of course, I'm very familiar with the idea that we use wetlands all over the world, not just the United States, for clean-up water. That's the nature's kidneys idea. So we've institutionalized it, and it's an industry. The idea of taking the plants and using them for fuel, it's an obvious thing that we should have thought of a long time ago. If we're creating all that biomass, we should do something with the biomass. So it makes intellectual sense to me. The practical aspects are a whole other story, because really, when you rely on photosynthesis for your energy sources, I'm sorry, we're not going to solve our energy problems with that. At best, nature converts about 2% of sunlight falling on an acre to biomass, 5% at the absolute highest that you can physically do. And that's just not much. And so you're never going to be able to solve your problem. And I'll even say that, you know, you couldn't grow enough wetlands to take all the carbon out of the atmosphere if we turned the whole United States of America into one big wetland. It's the amount of energy we're consuming, the amount of carbon we're putting in the atmosphere, all those numbers have like five more zeros on them. So they're not solvable by these ideas. But they're still good ideas.
An email from Lou, who writes, how can we get the local communities and state governments to stop allowing developers to fill in a wetland and then build a new wetland, a.k.a. pond, to replace what was lost? They certainly are not the same, but it continues in every community. It has to stop before every wetland we have is gone. What can we do?
Well, you know, there's several answers to that. Number one, as I said, we can build wetlands. The people who are doing it, though, the people that are doing the low bidding, if that, maybe that's one of the problems, don't know what they're doing. And they're primed for being substandard wetlands. Those are two separate questions, whether we can do it and whether they're being done right.
Is not a pond.
Yeah. I mean, the first thing is avoiding. I mean, that's the federal and the state policies are very clear on this. The first thing they want to do is avoid draining a wetland. Then they want to minimize the impact. And only the third thing is what he's described, where you absolutely can't avoid doing something to a wetland, then you have to – it's called mitigate. You have to mitigate that loss with doing something else. What I'm worried about now is, yes, they used to have this wetland substitution. Now they have in-lieu fees where you actually pay the government a fee and get out of it. And that just doesn't sound right to me. I'm sorry. And I know there are a lot of people that friends of mine that will hear me saying that and say, "What, Bill, what are you saying?" But it's just not right to just pay a fee and get off the hook. I think you have to be responsible for the new wetland that's created, and you have to post bonds on it. And if it doesn't work, you have to fix it. So, yeah, this whole business of replacing – we've become massively improved that whole process over the last 20 years. So there are some very nice created wetlands that I know about around the United States that have been replacement wetlands. And part of the Olentangy River wetland is, can I throw that
yes.
one in? 20 of the 30 acres there is mitigation for lost wetlands elsewhere. And I think we did good.
It's an amazing place.
Yeah.
You can see all kinds of wildlife there, all kinds of birds. It's beautiful. Right along the bike trail, you can access it along Ackerman Road.
Ackerman and Doddridge.
Doddridge, yeah. Right. And right by Olentangy River Road. And we'll put a link to the website for that park on our website at WOSU.org/allsides. I always see opportunity for wetlands, not mitigation, but I guess recreation or creation along the highways. Mm-hmm. You see it a lot up by Lake Erie, along the roads up there, but not so much anywhere else. And it's just sitting there, land.
Yeah, I mean, there's all sorts of opportunities for creating wetlands, and especially if people start realizing these services they provide, mm-hmm. especially if you have to clean up the water. Why not have a wetland that cleans up the water and provides a very nice, beautiful habitat, you know, so you can get a lot of bang for your buck out of wetlands.
Mm-hmm.
But you have to manage them.
How busy are you these days?
Pretty busy. It just seems to be a flurry of activities. Maybe it's partially wetland bonds, I'm not sure, but, you know, I spoke to China the other night. I don't even remember what it was. I guess the other night it was morning in China on CCTV. We have this webinar that's going on. I'm going down to the Ramsar meeting very 1st of June. So there's a lot of things going on, even when I come up here for the summer. And I'm sort of hiding from my, you know, I'm a 9-month position, so I can do that. But it stays busy.
The American Wetlands Month National Webinar on the Ramsar Treaty Convention on Wetlands. That's Wednesday, May 27th from 2 to 4 p.m. What do people see? What do they hear?
That's for people who have heard of the term Ramsar and nothing else.
Okay.
We're going to try to describe what it does, what the values would be if you had a site in Ohio, for example, that you'd like to propose as a Ramsar site. And maybe a little bit of detail on how you would go about that. But the detail,
it's going to be pretty high tech.
It's not so high tech. The document we did for the Olentangy River, we did that in a couple months. You have to get lots of political support. That's the important thing. We had 25 letters of support from our senators and, you know, local politicians and university people. And the letter was sent, or the package was sent by Gordon Gee to the Fish and Wildlife Service. So it's very doable.
Okay. Well, if you want to learn more about it, you can check out that webinar. Otherwise, Bill Mitch, thank you so much for joining us today.
Well, thank you very much. It's always great to be on this program with you, Ann, and I'll come back anytime you ask.
Appreciate it. That's William Mitch. He's director of the Everglades Wetland Research Park and founder of the Wilma Schiermeyer Olentangy River Wetland Research Park at Ohio State University, former founder and former director. And he is also the author of Wetlands. It's now in a fifth edition since March. It's considered the Bible. Thanks to everybody for listening. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.